This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today's topic is going to be state legislation allowing communities to implement clean energy and resilient solution, discussing the limits on utility franchise agreements. And Jerry Braun is going to start us off with a conversation about that. Jerry, go ahead.
Thanks, Sierra. I don't have a total comprehensive view of this, but I do know, having talked with recently with one of the folks at a large utility who basically is part of his portfolio is to manage the process of executing franchise agreements with local jurisdictions, and one of the things that I hadn't thought of, but seems to be a new scenario, and that is that a lot of cities and counties are facing some serious revenue issues in the pandemic and in the aftermath of the pandemic, and are looking at franchise agreements as a way of potentially shifting some of the getting help, basically. The only problem is that it's a zero-sum game in the sense that any revenue shift in terms of higher franchise fees would also mean higher rates, utility rates. But I guess the bottom line would be that there is obviously now an opening to initiate discussions, and obviously there's also an opening, I suppose, to look at possible legislation. But that's about all I have to offer at this point. I'm not familiar with any legislative proposals that are in the works, and I'm very interested if there are any.
Gary, this is Bernie Pelletier, and I dialed into this call because I don't even know what a utility franchise agreement is. While we track on this, could you just tell me what it is?
What are we talking about? Sure. I don't know whether it's all states. I can speak for California to some extent. The investor-owned utilities have there's legislation that gives them essentially a monopoly franchise, but not the details of it, simply the right to serve and not be subject to competition in the parts of the state where they are authorized to do that by legislation. As you probably know, the cities and counties can opt out by forming municipal utilities or in the case of rural areas, rural co-ops. But in the cases of cities and counties that are served by for-profit monopolies, utilities, energy utilities, there's a provision, and I'm not familiar with the law in any detail, but I believe there's provision in the law for the utilities to compensate cities and counties for basically the use of their rights of way, and other infrastructure. And so there's basically a negotiation once every decade or two to update those payments. That's about as far as I would go, because I don't have any expertise in this area.
And the transmission and connection savings slide, and then I was just looking at the
thank you
uh, TAC and ACC slides, and the I thought I'd
Craig,
there's a separate conversation.
Craig,
going on.
Do you mean to be talking on the call?
Sure.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about that. Like I said, this is the first time I've ever had the panelist show up. So just a second here.
This is Kleena.
Oh, very good. You came. All right, Kleena, why don't you take over from here and talk about that topic about the utility franchise agreements.
All right. I was gonna start with the state legislation allowing communities to implement clean energy and resilient solutions.
Perfect. Yeah. And please, everybody else, make sure your phones are muted so that we're not hearing background noises. All right. Go ahead, Kleena. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the big news in Virginia out of this year's General Assembly session, which the just ended in April, on the 22nd, the General Assembly came back to act on governor's vetoes, is the Clean Energy Economy Act that vastly expands the amount of renewable options available for communities. Prior to this, we had in Virginia, we've had something called the PPA pilot, the Purchase Power Agreement pilot, which had a strict limit, a strict cap on the number of megawatts that could apply towards that pilot. And the way it was basically implemented was if you wanted to have renewable generation on site and to finance that, you were using a power purchase agreement with a supplier that was permitted, but only up to a certain amount. And that cap was basically reached end of 2019, beginning of 2020. So what happened in this year's General Assembly was the cap got increased to 500 megawatts for non-jurisdictional customers and then another 500 megawatts for jurisdictional customers. In Virginia, you've got the unusual situation of the State Public Utility Commission governing the rates, terms, and conditions of basically non-governmental customers. So if you're a state government, local government, federal government customer, you are not within the rate regulation authority of the commission, which means if you choose to, you can contract directly with the utility for your rates, terms, and conditions of service. And that distinction was also brought into play in the legislation of the Clean Economy Act that got passed, which basically vastly increased the cap on the PPAs to basically 1,000 megawatts, half of it to basically non-governmental customers and the other half, 500 megawatts, to governmental customers. That legislation, it was enactment clause 2, part of the Clean Economy Act, that also raised our net metering cap. That had been at 1% statewide, and that's now increased to 6% statewide. So that there's been considerable movement on many fronts in the Clean Economy Act. This is just part of what happened. And so basically at the beginning of the year, we Fairfax County had done a big solar PPA, which basically halted everybody else from other localities from doing it because the cap was used up, and now the cap it's available to other localities.
Okay, is that all you wanted to say on that, or are you? Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Barrett, I see you joined the call. Why don't you expound on this topic a little bit? Barrett Brown, attorney from Pennsylvania.
Thanks, Sierra. I apologize for joining late. I didn't seem to have received an invitation that got on my calendar, so I wasn't expecting this. However, what I guess would be worth talking about is what we've just, and maybe some other things, but what we've just been working on in Delaware is legislation which has been formally proposed. The Delaware legislature is currently not in session for some, you know, until the virus lets it be, which is awkward because they're meant to have a budget by the end of June, and normally they'd be busily at that, among other things. But it's all drafted and in the hopper. And what it would do is two things. One, it amends their renewable portfolio standard to create a special tier for community solar, but that's not community solar in the way it's defined in some other states. It's community solar projects that are arranged by a new kind of entity that's a municipal sustainable energy authority, and we basically the rest of the legislation and what I'm excited about it creates a new category of municipal authority that any city or county in Delaware is empowered to create for itself that would have the ability to, and at one level be a community aggregator, although it's far more than that. It's it doesn't have the power to automatically include all citizens in a jurisdiction within its projects, like a community choice aggregator in California does. People would have to sign up, but it has far broader powers to create individual projects for which people can sign up and to partner with all kinds of third-party service providers to you know, create projects or tax investors or whoever is necessary. And it goes beyond just solar. It goes to energy efficiency, microgrids, any kind of project that would serve either community clean energy goals or community resilience goals. So, you know, it has, I don't know how my experience is that most jurisdictions have some form of legislation that allows municipalities to create authorities for one thing or another. In Pennsylvania, for example, where I'm from, there's a generic Municipal Authorities Act, which allows you to create municipal authorities and joint municipal, you know, which can be for one municipality or one jurisdiction or multiple jurisdictions for a wide variety of purposes, although not, as it happens, too broadly for energy-related things. I'll come back to that. But in Delaware, and I take it in some other states, there's specific legislation that allows you to create water and sewer authorities and, you know, and other legislation that allows creation of municipal utilities, which this is not. But there was no generic legislation. You could do a municipal parking authority, for example. But so this allows specific authorities with, you know, that become bodies corporate and politic and have all the powers to that they need to, you know, enter into contracts. We gave them some powers to finance, but Delaware already has a statewide agency called the Delaware Sustainable Energy Utility, which is has the power to finance these projects, and we sort of referred the ability to finance through the issuance of municipal bonds to the Delaware Sustainable Energy Utility and said that they could, you know, they could take their projects to the Sustainable Energy Utility for bond financing if that's what was useful. But it allows the municipal authority to act as an aggregator, as I said at the beginning, and to serve, to buy and sell services, power, and things like that. So that it gives it a lot of room and flexibility to help create projects. And I know from the work we've been doing, I was really on the drafting side, but although I took part in some of the conversations with the local utility and others to sort of vet some of the ideas, but there's ongoing conversations on the political side as well. This is being sponsored by Senator McDowell, who's head of both the Energy Committee and the Joint Appropriations Committee in the Senate, so carries a significant amount of weight. And apparently several Wilmington and a couple of other major jurisdictions within Delaware are already excited about setting these things up as soon as it's possible. So I hope it'll become a useful model. And by way of the kinds of things, I'm happy folks are interested to kind of share what we've done. I think now that it's sort of been publicly announced, it would be safe to do that. By way of addition, in terms of what such organizations can do, I also represent the Philadelphia Energy Authority, which is formed as a municipal utility in Pennsylvania, a municipal authority, excuse me. And as I indicated earlier, Pennsylvania authorities have sort of limited powers to do direct hands-on ownership of energy type things. However, they can be formed as business improvement districts, which this one was, who are empowered to help bring new industry, support growth of industry within the city. And this one was formed specifically to promote a clean energy industry within Philadelphia, ranging from energy efficiency, education of consumers to renewable energy and other kinds of things. So with that as a mandate, and with such powers as they do have under the Authorities Act, they've been doing everything from a solarized program that's now I think the largest in the country, putting solar on individual rooftops and collective procurement to bring down the component prices in that process, as well as pre-approved vendors. And they have been doing programs for family low-income housing, for energy efficiency. They've been doing energy efficiency for the Philadelphia schools. And they've been doing, they're working on establishing their own green bank. They are moving to, they're doing a pilot for low-income solarization, you know, solar on individual row houses, of which we have a lot of low and moderate income folks inhabiting such housing in the city. Working to bring that down to affordable scale. So if you have such an organization, even with limited powers, there's a huge amount that you can accomplish. And I commend it to folks for expanding on what they're doing in their corner of the world.
All right.
Hey, Baird?
One second here. And you want to introduce yourself, please?
Sure. This is Shalom Flank.
Okay, Shalom, go ahead.
Sure. And, Baird, what you're describing in Delaware is very promising, and I do hope the legislature takes that up when they're back in session. It reminds me a lot of the Energy Improvement District legislation that we passed in Connecticut about 10 years ago now, in terms of the powers of the jurisdictional authority that could be set up. One of the issues that we encountered in Connecticut, and it's, you know, I think part of the planned topic of this call, is that I left in place the existing franchise arrangements for the investor-owned utilities. There were some slight modifications about point-to-point connections that utilities were obligated to make between generation and load, but you still couldn't cross a right-of-way, which is how the franchise is set up in Connecticut. Is that addressed in the Delaware legislation, and what are your thoughts about the best way to approach that?
Well, as you appreciate, Sean, the franchise rules are all over the map in different states. In many states, Massachusetts, one that I happen to be familiar with, the franchise power, the actual power to have, and the District of Columbia for that matter, although it's, I guess it's a state in effect as well, are municipal and not statewide. And so, you know, municipalities can actually do that for themselves. But I don't think, as I said, this was not, Delaware actually has a bunch of municipal utilities, but, you know, the territory is carved up between the existing municipals and the existing incumbent IOU and Delmarva, which, and it would be very difficult to create a new one, and that was not the purpose. So you'd probably be limited to stringing wires within a, you know, within contiguous properties in a microgrid kind of circumstance.
Well, that's quite a bit if that becomes possible without having to go through the full setup process for a new municipal utility, which is in most jurisdictions very difficult to do.
Yeah, well, ask Sierra about Boulder's life in the last.
I know. No, please go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
We're going to keep comments a little bit on the short side because we have a lot of people on this call right now. So any people?
Just wanted to comment on Connecticut. Charlotte,
this introduce yourself.
Larissa Dobriansky, General Microgrid. Shalom, you know, I'm glad you're on because when Baird was talking, yes, all of that, the energy improvement districts came back to mind and you were directly, you know, a part of that in terms of Connecticut. But Connecticut is, to me, still one of the only jurisdictions that followed that up, you know, did adopt that kind of legislation for energy improvement districts, but also, to me, has the only legislation I'm aware of, but I can't say I've been focusing on this, that actually does allow for microgrid development that can cross public waves if this is developed in conjunction or by municipalities. I don't know how it's been evolving on the ground, but they did open up, and this was post-Sandy, and part of their evolution, their microgrid program and all. But actually, that is one state that has addressed this and is allowing for crossing public right-of-ways if you have the municipal engagement directly or indirectly.
Right, although, as Baird was saying, it's different in each jurisdiction. In Washington, D.C., for example, you can cross public rights of way all you want. You just can't make a retail sale of electricity without becoming a regulated public utility yourself.
Under that would not trigger public utility. I don't know how it's been working on the ground, but it was an opening. No?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. In Virginia, the role of the municipality is key, as we were hearing at the beginning of the call, and I'm sure
but
other people
in this is beyond the Energy Improvement District. This was separate legislation. You know, they had legislation to allow municipalities to adopt energy improvement districts, and I think that's invaluable. I hope we see more of this, but it was moving slowly, and I think there are a lot of bugs related to this, but I think we need more of this kind of legislation, and, you know, in terms of what also here Baird is describing. But beyond that, there was specific legislation defining microgrids in Connecticut and also allowing for their expansion and support specifically through municipal engagement. And so that was a separate, not under the, Energy Improvement District.
That's
Larissa,
correct.
We need to give some other folks here a chance to talk, and Shalom. Anybody else? I'm sure other people have comments, so anybody else wants to jump in here? Introduce yourself,
Bob Perry. Yeah, this is Bob
Perry. Please,
Perry.
Let's keep our comments a little on the short side again, because we have a group today.
Sure, yeah. This is Bob Perry. I'm in California. I'm working with a group that we actually had bills introduced onto the floor, SB 1314, the Community Energy Resilience Act, and then SB 1240, which would have opened up, required the Energy Commission to study the possibility of an open access distribution system operator. These bills, the pandemic, you know, sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and these bills have been tabled, but we're trying to get them back on the floor. But basically what SB 1314 would do would require utilities to work with communities, and it would provide funding for programs to integrate energy into the community general planning process. It would there would be a energy resiliency officer, and a program would be set up to help communities plan for energy within their community and require utilities to work constructively with communities. Rule 218, which is California's over the street rules, would probably have to be significantly restructured in that instance. But that's what's on the books in California.
Yeah, this is Baird.
All right, is there it? Yeah, Baird, go ahead.
Thanks for your roles in that. I mean, I also represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition, and we've been, sort of pushing those those things along as well. And 218 has really got to go. But good luck to us all.
Yeah. Ali Detrio's in that group. I know you know her.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody else who has not had a chance to talk yet like to say something?
Hi, this is Vu Nguyen.
Hi,
and
go ahead.
I just want to make a quick comment regarding the franchise agreements here. I mean, right now, the franchise agreements that I'm familiar with are ones that allow that essentially provide the municipality with free energy in exchange for the use of the public right of ways, right? But let's not, I mean, it's not really free energy. It's going to be paid for ultimately by the residential and the businesses that are, taking regular service from the utilities there. So, I'd be open to talking with anybody offline, about that. But I think that to the extent that clean energy and resilient solutions can be implemented, though, that does mitigate the impact on businesses and residential customers. And I think that's a priority in this current COVID situation. Thanks.
Any comments? And Artie, do you have anything to say?
No, thank you, Sarah. Not at the moment.
Okay. Craig, you're on the phone. You're unusually quiet. You say, I think he's here.
Yeah, I'm here, Sierra. Unfortunately, I've been jamming on a couple other things at the same time, so I've only caught about 10% of this. So I don't want to just jump in blindly. I'm going to just stay quiet rather than waste everybody's time.
Okay, Larissa, I think you know, anybody else before that?
Well, I heard Sierra. I was just going to say something.
Yeah, go
about
ahead.
Virginia. This is Cleaner
yeah.
Rob.
Sure.
In Virginia, you've got two concepts. You do have the concept of a franchise agreement, which utilities generally to occupy cities. They have to go to the city and get permission. But you've also got the concept of the franchise service territory, and that's a creature of state law. So you've kind of got two different layers in Virginia. The franchise service territory at the state level is far more potent than what's, in my experience, and what cities have been able to get out of franchise agreements with individual utilities.
Okay. Anybody else? Larissa, I know you were about to say something. Feel free.
No, but I will.
No, go ahead.
I hope we get more of this kind of legislation. I think it's really important, and on all these fronts, from the standpoint of really empowering better the communities, vital given, you know, the increasing penetrations of distributed resource development, microgrids, and what these legislation can bring, because Bear went into it, you know, in terms of enabling the kind of state leadership support on resources, technical assistance, financing. It just puts it on the map, and I think it brings, you know, empowers the communities that become engaged, puts them at the table. And we need that kind of parity vis-a-vis utilities, specifically with respect to the development of these resources. And there could be a lot of creativity. I was glad to hear Sean speak up because, like I said, he was at the heart of these energy improvement districts. And I can't say I followed them. So one thing I'd like to see whether he thinks that they've cut any ground. I saw a lot of lack of momentum that things started. It looked promising, but kind of fell apart. Another comment, I was very surprised that I don't see this in New York State. You know, they've had such great, you know, the REV and so many things kicked off. But in hearing their projects, particularly when they did the New York Prize and the microgrid development over and over again, I heard about the difficulties logistically on the legal side with respect to microgrid development within municipalities, that it was such a slow process. They had no means for, like, one-stop shopping where this kind of legislation can bring about, where the parties in terms of legal permitting, different aspects that you have to, specifications, permitting, et cetera, on different fronts, different agencies. Here in New York, they're suffering greatly from having to go, you know, separately to all these different agencies, the different time frames, et cetera, really can rack up the transaction costs, time factor, and this kind of legislation can enable better one-stop shopping and coordination, and then, like I said, getting that state support. So I think it's really important to see expansion in these areas along all these different forms, like what Baird was saying, also in terms of the California. Hope these can become models and get out there and permeate. I was disappointed that I didn't see this kind of momentum attached to the energy improvement districts, because they could have brought more, but I think maybe it was more the timing just wasn't right. When that first came out, you didn't see this, distributed energy resources take hold and get that kind of market penetration they are now. But it takes us away from just the technology-specific orientation to more the partnerships and multidisciplinary.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Sarah, if I could
sure.
Make one comment on that and then ask a question to the group.
This is Shalom.
This is Shalom again.
Yeah.
In Connecticut, one example of a microgrid that has been implemented and is up and running, and has an interesting regulatory enhancement that really made it work financially. So I think it's worth mentioning. Is for the city of Bridgeport, and again, it's a municipal involvement. That's the off-taker, but it was commercially developed. And one thing that was key in making that work was the extension of the virtual net metering regulations from Class 1 renewables as defined in Connecticut to include the resiliency aspect. So power that is produced by the installation at Bridgeport City Hall can offset the electricity bills for other city properties, even if they're not physically connected. So they didn't need to worry about the franchise issues of running wires to connect that generation to other loads, because they could do it all through this billing mechanism instead. That enabled them to put in enough capacity to meet the resiliency requirements. So they're essentially exporting to the grid most of the time, but if there's an outage, they've got enough juice to supply all of those resiliency functions. It's very similar to Con Ed's offset tariff. We did quite a bit of work on the Hunts Point microgrid that's now in design there, where it's a similar strategy using the billing mechanism for normal operations, and then for black sky operations, you've actually got enough power to meet your requirements. So I just wanted to fill that in. And then I'm curious if there's anyone on the call who could provide an update about what's going on in New Jersey with the Town Center Microgrid program there, and whether the BPU is going to be introducing new regulations to make it easier to implement those, if anybody's tracking that issue.
Anybody?
Two things. One of the members of the Microgrid Resources Coalition has been tracking that closely, and since I haven't heard any reports, and he's a former staff member of the BPU, I really doubt there's been much progress, so I can't update you except to say not much is happening. I think I was focused in what I was saying earlier on sort of the agency to bring all the powers in one place to do projects. But I think what this call is pointing out, something, I've certainly raised earlier on these calls, which is the need for what I call a customer and community bill of rights. That is that, people can generate their own power. They can string their own wires within a microgrid. They can, do what it takes to serve their needs locally, and get third parties to help them do that. I don't know whether, I don't know that it's come up on these calls. There's a book that was put together by John Dernbach and Michael, I'm going to go blank on his last name, called the Legal Pathways to Deep Decarbonization, which is 40 or 50 chapters dealing with different aspects of the law that need to be amended or fixed in order to get to the low carbon world we hope for. And a guy named Mike Girard, and then another attorney, again whose name is escaping me, is leading a charge to get all the recommendations in that book turned into actual legislation, and they now have a website up and running, and I'll try and get a proper link back to Sierra, who can share it with people, for, you know, what people have drafted to help communities, among other things, and states move forward. In the particular connection of utility restrictions, that was something that was dealt with in my chapter of the book, and there's actually a Yale law student who's working through the auspices of the larger project to identify those restrictions in a number of jurisdictions as a start, I was just thinking that, you know, people on this call could contribute, you know, like it's Act 218 in California, it's whatever it is in six other jurisdictions. If people were willing to contribute where the problems are with the franchise stuff and the road crossing limitations, so we could be collecting them, that would be extremely helpful. And hopefully, slowly but surely, we'll move forward with drafting up sort of model suggestions. But I welcome people to point to any that they think have already happened.
Yes, please get any of that information to me, and I'd be happy to send it out. So, Jeff Hinsky, do you have anything to talk about here?
No, not really. I mean, we've done a number of projects with municipalities and things like that, but, you know, from a policy and law perspective, it's just something that, you know, I don't really keep too close a track on, other than a couple of the jurisdictions we're working in. So nothing really to substitute to add.
Okay, anybody else?
I have one comment to shoot in for discussion. To me, there may be the kind of restrictions that prevent this, but I do know certain jurisdictions where, in connection with these franchise agreements, I don't see legally why it has to be kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down, you know, sort of black and white situation. Because in some that I saw in terms of my work in California, the attitude was, you're either going to municipalize, or you kind of give away the store, and they didn't think differently given the natural monopoly. But given the economic, given the legal changes, given the evolution that's going on now, it would seem to me that this is an area ripe for refashioning, and in these negotiations, thinking in terms of the options that communities could have, and in terms of even supporting, helping to support grid services based upon the distributed resources that are developed within the jurisdictions. And it shouldn't be the kind of black and white situation in the past, unless you have a law, a state law, that really provides, grinds us in stone what the utility can get. But I haven't seen that in a lot of the jurisdictions in where in which I've been involved, and I think there is room from the regulatory side to change this and create more options in terms of the negotiations on these franchise agreements, to have them nuanced, more options, and even in terms of the planning, how to harmonize between communities, utilities, as well as the kind of service contracts that could be opened up, from a broader, less rigid type of franchise agreements.
Okay, any thoughts on that?
This is Jerry Braun.
Yeah, go ahead,
one
Jerry.
One thing is very, very interesting and very important information. A lot of different points of view that are very valuable. One thing that that hasn't come up that I think should be kept in mind is as cities and counties and authorities, local authorities, are empowered to do things in the energy sector, they need not just the legal authority and a lot fewer legal obstacles, but they also need capacity. And I think that's a major barrier once you do give municipalities an open path to engage, to do things like community solar, to microgrids, et cetera. At least in the small to medium-sized communities and counties and cities, there is nobody who has the right background. Obviously people can learn on the job, but who has the right background to really step into things and hit the ground running. And I think that's something that needs to be considered in the state legislation, that, you know, that takes money. And in the years to come, it's, you know, we're going to have some serious revenue problems locally. So somehow that capacity needs to be created.
Yeah, this
anybody? Go ahead.
This is Baird. I agree with that comment. It in Delaware, that form of help is sort of already there in the form of the Delaware Sustainable Energy Utility, which is specifically empowered in the legislation to provide some of that assistance. And in New York, for example, NYSERDA does a lot of that. For instance, they've been all around holding municipal forums on street lighting and things like that. So, I think that is a critical dimension, especially for the smaller municipalities. And agree with you completely.
Well, one thing, thanks, Baird. To clarify, and that is, I think that there are two things that are needed. You added the one that I hadn't really been emphasizing, and that is there's a lot of assistance available. There are a lot of folks who are ready and willing, practitioners who are ready and willing to help communities and help local jurisdictions. But you still need somebody in the local government who really has sort of an independent expertise to be able to, you know, work along, you know, to get these folks engaged, to steer things, to be the in-house expert who's credible with the local elected folks and so forth. That's what's needed, and that's where I'm really concerned that there's no funding right now.
Yeah, this is Bob Perry again. An observation. I don't know about the other states, but in California, I think the real obstacle is grid modernization and who pays for it. I mean, right now, if a developer wants to build a local project and export to the grid, the cost of updating that infrastructure is thrown entirely on the developer, and it makes it very difficult to justify those types of projects. If the community and the utility construct an energy plan, a local energy plan, using local infrastructure and identify areas of high potential, I'm thinking specifically of the commercial industrial areas of a community, then the community can go to the property owner, say, we have a plan, this is an area we identify, you can be part of that, and then enroll the owners collectively to be part of a broader solution. And I think right now, because we just kind of rely on developers to go to property owners ad hoc and go to them and pitch their deals. There's not a broader vision, and that's what these types of bills and SB 1314 would do, is would be to actually bring that into the planning process and provide some clarity to property owners who can develop these types of resources.
Anybody? Okay. All right. Well, if there's no more comments, we can go ahead and end the call. All right. So tomorrow we have another conference call, and it's going to be discussing community choice energy structures in New York, Massachusetts, California, Connecticut, and we had a couple people I'm not sure are going to be able to make it, but we have several people. Samuel Golding should be on that panel, as well as Jerry, I think you're coming back, Rick Brown and Peter Millman from Connecticut. So Bob Elliott is invited. I don't know what happened to him. He went to Ireland on something, and I haven't heard from him since. I hope he got back okay. So it's at noon again, Eastern time, and hope to see you there. And then on Thursday, we have a webinar that Jerry Braun is talking about, and he'll be talking about transitioning to decarbonized local fuel sources. So I hope you all can attend that. You should have invitations from me, formal ones, not ones through this group, but the regular invitations to that. So anybody else before we go? No? Okay. Well, thanks for everybody coming, and thanks to our panelists. Interesting discussion as usual, and hope to see you tomorrow. And I hope everybody's staying safe.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.